Coming up next, another edition of Reaching Out with Gregory Floyd, president of Teamsters Local 237.
Welcome to another edition of Reaching Out. I'm Gregory Floyd, president of Local 237 Teamsters. With me, our very special guest for the first time on Reaching Out is Congresswoman Nidia Velasquez. Congresswoman Nidia Velasquez was the first Puerto Rican woman elected to the Congress in 1992. She also has the distinction of having three boroughs, Queens, Brooklyn, and Lower Manhattan, in her congressional district. And I might say you may have one of the most diverse congressional districts in all of Congress.
That's correct.
Welcome to Reaching Out.
Thank you, Gregory. Thank you for having me.
We wanted to talk to you about some very important issues. Let's begin with a lot has happened in Puerto Rico in recent months with the change in governorship. Can you talk about those changes and what they mean for Puerto Rico? And also, can you talk about Puerto Rico in post-storm?
Well, yes, Puerto Rico for the last 10 years has been going through a very difficult financial crisis. And 5 years ago, declared bankruptcy, and they didn't have a legal framework to file for bankruptcy. So we passed legislation that will enable Puerto Rico to restructure its public debt in an orderly fashion. But the issue has been that though they are paying or working out the agreement to pay back the debt, we have to insist that austerity measures will not take Puerto Rico out of the deep recession that they have been facing for so many years, that whatever restructuring takes place has to be accompanied by economic development, and also to use this opportunity to call on the U.S. government's responsibility toward the people of Puerto Rico. So the problem has been that every 10 years or every 20 years, the economic model changes in Puerto Rico, not based in the needs of Puerto Rico, but on the interests of American corporations. So Puerto Rico went from agriculture to industrialization and then abandoned agriculture totally and industrialization, and went from a manufacturing sector that was thriving to a pharma presence. And then when the Congress terminated 936 section of the IRS code, that was a tax incentives that were provided to pharma, pharmaceuticals, and technology companies to come to Puerto Rico, invest in Puerto Rico, and create jobs. In 1996, that provision was grandfathered until 2002. And then when basically that tax credit terminated, many of those companies left Puerto Rico. And nothing was given. No public policy came out of Congress to help promote economic development and create jobs in Puerto Rico. So that is the economic situation and financial crisis that Puerto Rico has been in for the last 5-10 years. And so then it happens, Maria. And that was a lethal experience, devastated Puerto Rico. And as the world saw, 3,000 people lost their lives. And the president of the United States, Donald Trump, went to Puerto Rico. And the image that remained in the minds of so many people was a president that was throwing paper towel instead of, you know, providing meaningful help.
He was shooting them like they were basketballs.
I think he didn't understand the magnitude of the crisis in Puerto Rico. And so a lot of people resented that. And so after that, Puerto Rico has been struggling to recover. The power grid was totally devastated. Some places in Puerto Rico didn't have electricity power for almost a year or a year and a half. And without power, not much economic activity can happen. And there it goes. Again, that was another blow to the lack of economic activity in Puerto Rico. So then there was this chat that was discovered where the governor of Puerto Rico basically was discussing things that were not appropriate and criticizing and using words that were not appropriate for the governor to calling out his political enemies.
Sure.
And so the people got the frustration and the hostility that people were feeling, coupled with what they realized that they're... So for many years now, people have been talking about corruption in Puerto Rico and so on, but it was there in full display for the people of Puerto Rico to see. And so... hundreds of thousands of people took it to the street to demand for the governor of Puerto Rico to resign. And he tried and tried and tried, but every single day they didn't give up. The people got upset. They were just fed up with the situation. And you saw the strength and the resiliency when they collectively decided that it was enough and that they needed a new beginning, a new government.
So there were, by some people's account, a million people protesting.
Yes, a million people. A million yeah. people. And, you know, it was just an incredible image, the collective desire to bring about change. And to demand accountability, to hold the governor and the government of Puerto Rico accountable. What a lesson of democracy. You didn't hear one person that was shot.
No.
Not a single shot. And yet there was regime change.
Who's in charge of Puerto Rico now? Who's the governor of Puerto Rico?
So the governor of Puerto Rico, based on the succession as established by the Puerto Rican Constitution, is the former Secretary of Justice, Wanda Vazquez. She's the new governor. I met with her. She came to Washington. I promised to work with her on any way that we could be helpful in Washington. And I also reminded her that people are frustrated, that people are fed up, that they are demanding justice, and they are demanding transparency from their elected officials. And as long as she understands that she has to be transparent, I will be there helping to secure resources for Puerto Rico.
Is there anything else the U.S. government can do to assist the people of Puerto Rico at this moment?
Yes, the problem is that, as I mentioned to you before, even when some public policies were enacted to help promote economic activity in Puerto Rico, the same way that Congress provided those incentives, the same way they took them away without providing anything else. And then the treatment that Puerto Rico gets. These are American citizens. They go to war. They die for our country. They fight for our freedoms. So the government, the U.S. government, has a responsibility. And so let's say that the biggest issue that Puerto Rico is confronting today is access to health care. So Puerto Rico, because it's not a state, they get a block grant for Medicaid reimbursement. And Puerto Rico was able to have parity on Medicaid like any other state, but the Congress stopped that in 1984. So I introduced legislation. This is the biggest expense for the government of Puerto Rico. They must provide access to health care. And if they don't have the money, they will borrow the money. And that explains the fact that Puerto Rico continued to borrow money that was very expensive And now they have been in this financial crisis for the last 10 years. So I introduced legislation that will give Puerto Rico parity in terms of Medicaid, because otherwise the senior population and the children will not have access to health care. A lot of the professionals in the medical profession have left Puerto Rico because Puerto Rico gets only, I think it's 53 cents per every dollar that you get in the United States. So this is the reason why I am calling for providing parity for Puerto Rico. In the States, they get 83% reimbursement. That's the rate. While in Puerto Rico, you get 55%. No doctor who is paying student loan of $200,000, $300,000 is going to stay in Puerto Rico just to get a reimbursement rate right. of 55 cents.
Yes.
And then the other area is, as we saw, Puerto Rico has a problem with accessing food. And we don't have a hub in Puerto Rico. So if after Maria, Puerto Rico was running out of food, because if you don't have transportation and you don't have power, the food will rotten, and yes. you need to have to make sure that there is that the food that is needed is transported. But the other problem that Puerto Rico is facing is access to the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, SNAP. In Puerto Rico, 61% of the children live in poverty, and yet they are not, the kind of money that they get is a block grant. So for if a family of four in the United States, you get close to $600, $700. In Puerto Rico, only $400. So I introduced legislation that will provide parity in the area SNAP, you know, the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. And it's a recognition that in the most powerful, wealthiest country in the world, no child right. should go to sleep hungry.
You're listening to Reaching Out. I'm Gregory Floyd, President of Local 237 Teamsters. Our very special guest is Congresswoman Nidia Velasquez. We wanted to also talk to you about a big announcement you made.
Mm-hmm.
Public housing, which is dear to your heart, NYCHA. You made an announcement to propose a financial infusion investment into NYCHA. You want to tell us about that announcement?
Well, as you know, Greg, you know yes. better than many other people here in New York and even in our nation, because your members, a lot of them work for the New York City Housing Authority. And the New York City Housing Authority used to be one of the best agencies run in our country. And yet now, because of the disinvestment that has taken place for the last basically 15 to 20 years, what we see every time that the winter is here is just, you know, public housing developments without heat, without hot water, or with mold. And the state of disrepair in those public housing, it just is shameful. It is not the right thing. You know, morally speaking, no child should be exposed to mold. No senior should be exposed to mold, or children to lead. So what I did is introducing legislation that will declare and it will recognize that the state of public housing in the United States is reaching, is an emergency, that we need to deal with it. And we cannot resolve the state of disrepair of public housing in our nation just by putting Band-Aids. $1 billion in allocation every year will not cut it. It will not do it. So we need to be bold and once and for all have the commitment to allocate the kind of money that will enable NYCHA and all the public housing authorities across the country based on the physical assessment report that they submit to HUD to be able to access the kind of resources that will enable them to improve the conditions and modernize public housing. This is an incredible housing stock, and for many low-income, moderate-income, and the most vulnerable, if they cannot live in public housing, where are they going to go? They will go to a shelter that is so costly to the city of New York. So I am asking for $70 billion, and based on the formula and based on the physical assessment report that every public housing authority submits to Congress and to HUD, New York City Housing will stand to win $32 billion.
And they say the state of capital improvements is about $32 billion.
32 in yes. New York. Yeah, yes. 32. And that's what they yes. basically they will get. And these numbers are based on what housing experts are telling us and advocacy groups. So, look, people are saying, oh, do you really think that you're going to get this? Well, not necessarily at this moment, but we need to start someplace, and we need to raise the profile of the incredible conditions, physical conditions, and the state of disrepair of public housing. What you see is presidential candidates discussing, yes, climate change is a very important issue. They're discussing prescription drugs, student loans, but no one is talking about public housing.
Thank you. But you're talking about public housing.
And, oh, yes.
And we hope we are able to inject that into the conversation. And in New York City, they're estimated 500,000 people living in public housing.
Yes. We're nationwide, it's 2 million people.
And a quarter of those people live right here in New York City.
That's right.
And I've been looking at some trends over the last few years, and public housing has been the only diversity that I see for the future, because New York demographics are changing mm-hmm. and people are coming. And when the demographics change, the city changes. So for the elected officials who want to have a diverse community, public housing is the only diversity we have in our city at this moment.
That's right. And we want to take this opportunity once we get those the type of resources that are needed to not only to modernize public housing, but at the same time to make all these public housing developments more resilient so that the next storm, the next hurricane yes. striking New York, that we have used technology and changes that are needed to make those projects more resilient.
And say anybody listening in public housing, the one thing that public housing residents don't do as well as they should is vote.
Right.
You vote, you just need to vote. I'm not saying who to vote for, but you need to participate in the process.
That's
and vote.
Right. It is important. Yes. It is important for people to understand that when they walked into a polling site, it doesn't matter if next to you is a billionaire, he has one vote, you have one vote. And the fact that not too many elected officials or those running for president are discussing public housing is this perception that those who live in public housing don't vote, or that they are the poor. Well, you're poor, but you have a vote. And if you could flex your political muscle, I can assure you that people will pay attention to the needs of the residents who live in public housing.
Once again, you're listening to Reaching Out. I'm Gregory Floyd, President Local 237. Our very special guest is Congresswoman Nydia Velazquez. Before our time is up, I want to get your take on the events unfolding in Washington. We're going to leave politics out of it. Let's go with the facts. There's an impeachment inquiry.
Mm-hmm.
And facts are starting to come out even as we speak, and probably more facts will come out before this program will air the very next day. How do you describe the impeachment atmosphere in Washington, D.C. now?
So given the facts that we have before us, it is important that we do the impeachment inquiry. We know, and it's a fact, and the president admitted it, that the president placed a call into a foreign country into a foreign president, the president of Ukraine. And we also know that the Congress appropriated military assistance to Ukraine, who has been threatened by Russia. Russia invaded Crimea. And so the Congress approved this money because, you know, the lives of the Ukrainian people depend on security. And part of that is the foreign assistance aid that we provided to Ukraine. That money, that financial aid that was appropriated by the Congress, you have to remember, there is a separation of power and there is check and balances. That's what the Constitution, that is how the Constitution created our government. So we control, we have the power of the purse. We decide how money is going to be spent. So we decided to provide this military aid to Ukraine. And yet the president of the United States withheld that aid. And we did not know why. Well, that phone call that he placed into the president of Ukraine, asking the president to do an investigation into Joe Biden, explain why that military aid was withheld. So for the president of the United States to invite a foreign president from Ukraine to meddle in our political system, that is an abuse of power, is considered an abuse of power. The United States, to invite a foreign country to interfere in our election, to undermine our democratic institution. So, look, we are not saying it. It was corroborated by the memo and the notes that were taken from the president's call. So it is important that we do this impeachment inquiry so that we have the opportunity to bring the witnesses before the committee, for the witnesses to answer questions, for the witnesses to provide documentation and provide the information. And then at the end of this investigation, the people of this country will decide whether or not there is, so this is like a two-pronged approach. Once this investigation is concluded, I'm sure that the public opinion will play an important role in terms of impeaching the president and then getting the Senate to do their own judgment, to make their own judgment.
Thank you. You laid out the case as far as we know. At this far, facts are coming out. I believe you have one of the officials from the state government, from the State Department testifying. You're going to have a lot of evidence. I believe there's text messages, and there's just a lot of documentation that is coming out as we speak that doesn't look very good. And I believe Rudolph Giuliani is not in the middle of it. He's at the beginning of it. He's one of the orchestrators.
He just, Giuliani, you know, without being an official of the government, has been playing an important role in making the president believe that Ukraine played a role in the election in 2016. And the ambassador to Ukraine and to the European Union, both of them made it clear. And you're going to see that in the notes and the text messages and how they, the information that they provided yesterday to the Intel, committee.
Thank you. Unfortunately, that's all the time we have for reaching out. We invite you to come back.
Thank you for having me. I'm sure I'll be back.
Thank you for coming to Reaching Out. I'm Gregory Floyd, President of Local 237 Teamsters. Very special guest, Congresswoman Nydia Velasquez. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening, and don't forget to tune in again each and every Saturday at this same time for another edition of Reaching Out with Gregory Floyd, president of Teamsters Local 237.